My name is Daniel Ashman. I've been campaigning and holding vigils outside of complicit sites with the genocide of families in Gaza. So this initiative is really about trying to raise awareness about the fact that in UK law, legislation exists to empower us to stop and prevent the aiding and abetting of genocide. And in fact, there is a lawful legal duty to prevent in all forms aiding and abetting to what is happening in right now, and indeed the way it's spreading.
Okay, now, so, just let me stop you because you're breaking up a bit. I don't know what the connection's like, but you're going to have to switch off your camera because that will give the bandwidth okay, to no the worries. Sound, okay?
No worries.
So I can use that, no problem, but I don't want it to, you know, get any worse, and so I can't. So anyway, so could you just take us through what you know, a bit about your background, Dan, really? Where are you coming from?
Okay, so I'm a Leicester lad, born and raised in Leicester. I've worked within the community sphere professionally and voluntarily most of my adult life. I've done support work, care work, worked in community centres, ran food pantries, and I've also done quite a fair amount of campaigning. And I crossed the threshold really into. Strong campaigning, let's call it, back in 2011 at the time of Occupy. So I stayed at Occupy London outside St Paul's and outside the Stock Exchange for 4 months and participated in the court case as a litigant person, which they subsequently used really to try and limit human rights, freedom of expression and assembly. And that's what the City of London were trying to do in getting that case law. And unfortunately, they did get some of that case law. But nevertheless, the necessity for us to commune and for us to try and cultivate a better environment and fairer way of dealing with things is very much takes precedent, really. Because the consequences of today's, I'll call it cartelism and greed, is that it's deadly for quite a few people.
Look, before we get on to the genocide, it's fascinating to hear that you've been involved in campaigning in, you know, in the city, because this is a bit of an anomaly. What most of us sort of pass through the city, we see these dragons with these big red crosses, upside down crosses, as you go in and out of the City of London. But what role does it play in Britain? Because we, you know, I think it's a bit of a mystery to most of us.
Exactly. I think when I'll just preface this a little bit, because we're not largely taught about the historical significance of, say, the merchant class, and which the City of London really were. They were kind of like the business class of the age of over 900 years ago, and they're quite a powerful. They accumulated a lot of wealth, and they formed livery companies. And now these livery companies are now more turned into a kind of ritualistic clubs where they do what's it called? Kind of benevolent type actions in order to kind of underscore the social good compared to the networks which spring from the City of London with colonialism. Financial institutions were put across the world, and the City of London, a square mile, the Royal, it's not called the Royal Mile, it's called Square Mile, is largely a place where it's about a fifth of the financial economy runs through this kind of area, and the networks of tax havens which were installed during the colonial era. And with the end of the Second World War, a rebranding exercise happened where this was the Commonwealth, and the governments had a choice to either be part of the Commonwealth or not. Really, what happened was the deals were made between the UK government and the City of London, who have a permanent seat in Parliament, which is known as the Remembrancer. And they've got they've basically got a bird's eye view of kind of what's happening in the country, and really the governance kind of network throughout the last hundreds and hundreds of years have been a kind of a coalition which has had infighting before between the religious institutions, the financial institutions, and the kind of bloodline institutions, which like royalty, the idea that God ordains these particular people to rule over everyone, and everything they say is sacrosanct. And anyone who goes against it is committing a sin against God and this deserves to die, treason, etc. So it's and actually it's a very, very brutal history in terms of repression, in terms of people's movements. And actually, we've along this, I've learned a lot about folk culture, and actually the movements for democratic representation were going on hundreds and hundreds of years ago. You know, we had the levellers, we had the diggers, which were about, we take up space. As people, we take up space, we are sacred, and we're going to grow our food. And of course, that movement didn't last too long because the feudal landlords kicked them all off and destroyed that movement. But there was other movements, religious movements, like the Quakers, like that came about in about 1651, which is still very, very strong and resilient and believes life is sacred. Everyone has a life within. So around, especially around kind of Civil War period within English history, there was a lot of breakout groups, there was a lot of social conscious justice things which were happening at a grassroots level. And we don't get taught about that either.
We don't. And of course, this was as a result really of the Church of England at the time. Being so pretty hopeless when it came to things like social justice. So in other words, any of the people that started to say, well, if the king's going, when the people need to kind of have a say, the church was involved in putting them down. But look, let's bring this up to today, and I know you've been looking at this whole idea of the legal system, which is where you started. Can you just take us through what you're doing and what you have been doing and why?
Over this last few years, I've kind of been sitting on my hands a little bit, trying to stay out of trouble, trying not to kind of get too engaged because, I'm trying to raise a son as well. And then really things got too much. I had a friend trapped in a place that was being bombed with a relative. And I had to try and do something really. And one thing which I would say, I saw an opening in my own humble assessment was that the legislative pathways, because of my past experience in campaigning, I'm aware of and actually representing myself in court, which I normally lose, but nevertheless, I learned an awful lot about the various legislation can be called, invoked or provoked and called into play. And so we have the Geneva Convention, which is quite famous because it was probably one of the wins that came out of the Second World War, which was a recognition that we can't carry on this way. And from the actual people who perpetrated the crimes and the harms, and they signed up to the Rome Statutes. And with the Geneva Conventions in it, it's absolutely clear that genocide is the worst crime you can do. It is by far the worst you can do because it's systemized murder of unarmed peoples. And if you read it, you don't have to be a lawyer to understand this. There's a spirit of intention within this kind of international legislation. It got encodified into British law. Actually, there was a Geneva Convention Act, but I think it was 1949, I'm not too sure exactly, or 1952, I can't remember off the top of my head. But then it got reaffirmed because there have been protocols added to it since in 2001. So the Geneva Convention exists in domestic law because the ICC, the International Criminal Court, and the ICJ are reliant on states to enforce international law, because they've only got, like, I think 32 judges, is it, in the ICC? I mean, it's not a very robust, big organization. It's meant to be that the various states around the world, they're meant to bolster it with their law enforcement agency. And what we found is, when it comes to families in Gaza, it's not happening. It just isn't happening. We had Keir Starmer, not 2 years ago or so, or quite close to when the bombardment started and Israel had cut off food to the entire population of the Gaza Strip. We had him coming on TV saying, that's fine, that's okay. They've got a right to defend themselves. And so, and there is a point within this legislation which absolutely makes it unequivocal that those who do the crimes are the ones that should be stopped, and collectivized punishment is illegal. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist. I'm not a rocket. I'm just a guy, right? And a bit on the slow side. So, but I can see that starving 2.2 million people for the crimes of between 900 to 3,000 people is collectivized punishment, you know? And so I started these vigils to really trace the legal liability of the governmental institutions, and we'll move on to the financial. We've got pension funds, we've got... It's a target-rich environment, really. There's quite a few. It's easy to be intimidated by kind of the sprawling network, but actually, it's not that many people, and we're millions and billions if the wave takes us. You know, so that's what I'm trying to invoke. I'm trying to get them with their flawed systems and cultures to actually enact actually the more benevolent side, the recognition of the sacredness of civilians' lives. And there's quite a lot, really, I could talk in terms of international law where it absolutely fails unarmed people. And I'm quite sympathetic to the argument that even the Geneva Conventions and the like are kind of fig leaves, which especially heavily developed, highly technological militaries can hide behind to kill indiscriminately civilians.
Daniel, you're painting a picture here of a system of international law which really isn't working. So if it were to work, first of all, whereabouts have you been doing these vigils and why? And then if you could move on to just explain how international law should work. And quite clearly, people who are committing war crimes take a little bit of trouble beforehand to make sure that they're somehow going to be shielded from prosecution. They're not that stupid that they just go and do it and get prosecuted. So if you could just answer those two, like, where have you been doing the vigils and why? And secondly, what might be a proper route to actually prosecute people?
I started off at Downing Street because the Prime Minister has ultimate culpability, and then went off to the Ministry of Defence, and obviously you've got the Secretary of Defence, which is in there, and you've kind of got the hierarchy within that organisation. I list them actually on the electronic flyers, which I kind of post about and try and encourage other people to come and spread the knowledge a bit. And then we went to, I can't exactly remember the order now because I've done a few. We've done the Home Office. So Yvette Cooper is really in charge of policing policy and policing emphasis. So recently, you know, it's quite famous. Yvette Cooper decided that the people who were trying to stop genocide by sabotaging or grounding planes are now terrorists, even though nobody was harmed, and harm was kept to a minimality. in order to stop a far greater harm. So she's made some groups illegal, but she also directs police in policy. So between them and the higher ups in the police force, it's a very hierarchical structure, the police force. But I'll come on to the police in a minute. So with the Home Office, they've kind of got culpability, and then you've got the Foreign Office as well, and they deal with, look, there's lots of crossover, right? Because we've got international trade deals, we've got coalitions and the like. So with the Foreign Office, run by David Lammy, you know, his speaking is of acknowledging the horror, but ultimately providing political cover for participants in the war crimes. So the head of the Israeli Air Force came over, not was it 2-3 weeks ago now? Came over, attended the Royal Tattoo, and possibly networking with other militaries from around the world. I think Switzerland was there, Canada Air Force was there, representatives, you know, generals or and the like. And he's overseen the collectivized punishment and destruction of the infrastructure, which actually destroys, brings about, and this is the legal bit, the destruction or the conditionalities imposed upon the Palestinian people destroy life in part or in whole, and it's deliberate. Now, with that, they try and use these linguistic games of saying, no, well, we're not trying to do that, so you can't prove intent. Look, we're saying publicly that we're not trying to do it, but they've also said publicly that they are, amongst their own kind of culture and in Israel, you know, and the like. And that's why South Africa has been able to been granted that there's a plausible case of genocide happening, but that it moves very, very, very slowly, the legal system, so slowly. So we've got the Foreign Office, and then after the Foreign Office, I went to the Met Police, because they've got a subdivision called the War Crimes Team, and it's actually a subdivision of the Domestic Extremist Unit and Terrorist Unit, of which a policeman came down and took a photo of me and sent it to them. But one thing which they haven't done, to my knowledge, is investigate any of the crimes which have been reported and are actually in full public knowledge. And we're watching them on X and on Facebook and on the various platforms. It's horrendous. It's actually very important that we do bear witness. It's heartbreaking. And it's obviously worse for the people experiencing it. So inter-solidarity is very, very important. So the police are meant to investigate and have the resources, although they will say they don't, to investigate the various lines of complicity of aiding and abetting, that's a legal term, aiding and abetting of genocide. They should be investigating it, all lines, whether it be financial, political, or you know, or material support, and then they all kind of amalgamate to material support. And to my knowledge, despite people putting in evidence, they have not moved on any of them. But what they are doing is they're moving in on campaigners. What they are doing is they're trying to find ways to suppress and shut down the recognition of the sacredness of the Palestinian families' lives and the movement toward preventing that continued harm. And that can only happen in the moment. Like, peace is an active process. It's not like a passive thing. It's an absolutely active process, because human relationships are hard. You know, they're difficult. There are misinterpretations. There are people who want different things.
Well, look, this description of the police only investigating their political opponents of the state. Now, the police are servants of the king. Yeah, that's where they swear their allegiance to. Now, this is sounding to me
Absolutely.
like a police state.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing because whether some, yes, they've got the totalitarian almost capacity, technological capacity for it to be a police state. I would always argue that actually, regardless of what someone else does, you also have your own agency. And although whatever pressures they put on you, and you know, history is full of subgroups trying to dominate other subgroups and using whatever methodologies and torture they have. The reality is, though, is that they're kind of almost locking us into this kind of cartel network, tax haven cartel network, and really that they're the tax haven class, which I would argue are really the clients of the crown. They're really the group, the culture that the police protect,
Yeah, well,
and
maybe you may be
and
right.
it's in the
Anyway,
crown interest.
can you you didn't finish with the Met Police, did you? I know you've done some more vigils too.
Yeah, so with the Met Police, it was fascinating, and really they actually also issue licenses for arms factory weapons sales. So if say a company wants to display a gun, for example, they issue a license, and so got the Desi arms sale, arms fair coming up, and they deal with that side of things as well. So they're fully aware that there are human rights abusive regimes there, but they don't investigate. They grant licenses, and so the UK Crown is kind of an intersection for an awful lot of trade in weaponry and oppressive totalitarian technology, and facilitate it. So yes, that's all going on. That's all happening, but a lot of it's made up. A lot of it's not true. So when these people playing roles for money, essentially, and we hope to get past that. That's where the transcendence is. That's where the cultural change will happen. With and then so after the police, I finally the latest one, the Ministry of Justice. So yes, the Ministry of Justice is an interesting one. So there's a role there, off the top of my head, isn't coming to me right now, but the Attorney General. So the Attorney General and amongst that institution, they determine with the evidence which is supplied by the police, what they're going to prosecute, whether it's in the Crown interest to prosecute, or whether there's not enough evidence. So, you know, famously, Jimmy Savile, for example, evidence was brought between to the Crown prosecution offices or the Ministry of Justice, and it was determined that there wasn't enough evidence to convict Jimmy Savile, for example. Let's just throw that one in there. Or it wasn't in the Crown interest to convict him, one or the other, or both. Who knows? So they play in the administrative and in the functioning of recognizing crimes. The police and the CPS, they work as a bit of a nexus, you know, in terms of process. And to my knowledge, nothing's happening in terms of the crimes we're seeing in Gaza. And they should be. And they're not.
Okay,
So I
so
think it.
I mean, if the law was to work, if international law was to start clicking home in Britain and start to move, the cogs start to turn, what should be happening?
Well, what should be happening is assets should be frozen. You know, like with Russia. Do you remember when Russia invaded Ukraine? they got rid of Abramovich, didn't they? Out of Chelsea, they were freezing bank accounts, they were freezing, they were saying you can't run businesses here anymore. The weapons factories should be shut down. The people who are travelling to the country who are involved in the genocide should be arrested on suspicion of participating. There's a whole kind of rafter of things which could happen. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that will end what the Israeli government are doing in Gaza. It means that the UK Crown, which does claim to represent the people, will no longer be participating. But there is a lawful and legal duty to stop genocide, to stop it from taking place. And so that then creates states that are supporting it and providing material support, military, spying, you know, intelligence, all of this stuff, were to stop. And then it would mean that they wouldn't be able to function in the same way that they are now.
Look, I think it's fair to say that the genocide wouldn't even have been contemplated if it hadn't been for the Israeli far-right racist genocidal government, as we now know it is, feeling that they had the confidence and support from the West. In fact, many have even said that Sunak called an early election because he didn't want to be involved in this. So, you know, Israelis would never have done this. In fact, many of the things that they've done since 1948, if they hadn't known that they were going to get support from Britain. So what's going on?
So they're an outpost to trade routes and in the Middle East. They're seen as a key ally, and it's part of the reason why it's been deemed in the Crown interest to not rein them in and then stop supporting genocide. But even really, the Genocide Convention is meant to be a higher law that overrides those interests. That's what it's billed as, and that's what's going to be tested. And well, it's been tested so far and failed, because we have failed, you know, the families of Gaza.
Well, I mean, there have been these judgments at the International Criminal Court, haven't they? Arrest warrants issued for Netanyahu, etc. Yeah. So, you know, something is happening, isn't it, around the world? The rest of the world can see this. It's just Britain is one of those countries that doesn't seem to be able to notice the genocide, despite Britain's role in the Second World War.
Oh, it absolutely notices. It absolutely notices. It's trying to play a tap dance with there's shares money to be made out of all the weapon sales and all of that stuff and the financial networks and centres which they all derive monetary value from. And then there's kind of like, say, the moral right to use violence, which governments claim. And so what they'll do is they'll kind of parrot the Israeli talking points. But it's kind of the dam's burst in that sense. The argument's been lost, because we can see it. We can, with the information that we can glisten and get, we can see it all. And there is the intention, of course, of America and Israel to ethnically cleanse Gaza, regardless of whether the hostages return or not. It's stated. It's kind of incontrovertible, you know. Like, so even the Israeli talking points are out of date. You know, those Israelis, and I want to make this absolutely clear: the Israelis that support the violent, total, violent, ethnic cleansing of Gaza, there are groups and there are people that absolutely oppose it. It's not representative of who they are, what they want to be a party to, and are actively on a grassroots level organizing, reflecting, communicating, and trying to support a different way. You know, so that is happening as well. And with language, we've just got to be careful, because sometimes it mothballs an awful lot of people. Do you know what I mean? It's into one group, and that's what Same as well.
You're right. It is complicated. Even talking about Zionists, there are Zionists I know that want to see Netanyahu in jail, and also embrace the original vision for Israel, which was living at peace with Palestinians. So even having a go at Zionists can sometimes be. But anyway, look, how can people find and follow you, Dan? Because I think it's an important initiative. Identifying the specific areas of government where war crimes are actually taking place in there, because anyone that's complicit in covering up genocide is themselves
Even
liable
in
to
action.
prosecution.
And it's really important to note, even in action is considered in the legislation to be a form of supporting genocide. Inaction is a form of being complicit in genocide. When it comes to the institutions that are meant to enforce the Geneva Conventions within the ICC Act 2001. So that I think that's really key, because there is part of me that believes that they're trying not to they're just saying, well, we did a little bit, we tried to do our best and what have you, and then people don't recognize that inaction is actually also a crime.
Yeah, so
So
anyway, if anyone is in London and would like to come along to one of your vigils and
so so
support in
so
some way, or even just share what you're up to, where can people find you?
well, so my name is Daniel Ashman. You can follow me on X, or Dan Ashman on Facebook, or you can check out the Occupy London Facebook page, because they kindly will share when these vigils are up and coming. I have been doing them on a weekly basis. This week, I'm not. Well, this next coming Monday, I'm not doing it because I'm taking my boy away for a short holiday. But and then in the following week, I, as of yet, not decided. It's such a target-rich environment that I've not decided what it is going to be yet. But
Right, so it sounds to
suggestions are
me like a
welcome.
surprise
And
attack.
people, well, it's just the thing is with it. What ideally, I hope, because there are a number of sites and in the very dimensions of our culture, the people start doing it themselves. So I do a 28-hour vigil. It starts at 7 a.m. in the morning on a Monday and then goes through to 11 a.m. on a Tuesday. But however, it doesn't have to be that long. It doesn't have to be that form. That's a form which I believe resonates actually with the people going into those buildings, because they're not happy. A lot of people aren't happy who are working in those buildings, and people will be surprised to know that. But I know that because I'm there. And ultimately, there are, what's the word? We transcend our roles, our fixed roles in work and everything on a more universal level. We've all got families, we've all got loves, we've all got friends, and we and that those make our lives good. And we and people know that what they're doing and what they're participating in is destroying that capacity for others, and there's
Well,
no
I mean,
heroic
maybe we
narrative.
need to replace these people who are going in and out of these buildings with AI that doesn't have a conscience.
Well, that's probably what's going to happen if the technological curve goes the way it does. But we still exist, and we still impose ourselves on the environment. We still are in relationship to everything because of what someone else is doing and what they're prepared to see happen for money or whatever. There's no way really shape. I mean, it can shape, because we're constantly cleaning up the mess of these people, of these big cartel tax haven class owners. Or they're considered owners legally in there, what have you. So we're constantly finding ourselves having to clean up environmentally, war. Like we're having to the climate. We're having to try and clean up after them all the time, with fracking, for example. I mean, that was a massive effort from a grassroots community level to kick it into the long grass. But I mean, it might be coming back soon, or they're trying to start issuing licenses again after Boris Johnson repealed that in 2019 because of the election. But, if it wasn't for the thousands and thousands and thousands of people that put in any way which they can, that would not have been achieved. And, you know, and it annoys the tax haven class because their money then doesn't hold the same power, you know, of getting them their will met. But that's okay. They need to get over it. It's not the same as ending someone's life, a concept. And that's the biggest takeaway, I think, from these Life is Safer individuals. When I think about the adults that think their concepts are more important than the heartbeat of a child, that's when there's the potential for genocide. That's when, if that there's sacredness not respected, the many thoughts, the many concepts that exist in even that one being, there's an adult there who thinks that their concept is more important than life itself, and it's disgusting.
Okay, Dan, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.